You're listening to the Sketchnote Army Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rohde, the author of the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook, and this is the podcast where I chat with sketchnoters and visual thinkers and try to understand what makes them tick. This episode of the Sketchnote Army Podcast is brought to you by the Sketchnote Handbook that tells the story of how I solved a note-taking problem and in the process coined the term sketchnotes. My best-selling book teaches you how to draw simply to capture ideas instead of worrying about art quality. It features simple-to-follow steps for building your drawing skills, helps you create a visual library, and showcases a wide variety of sketchnotes by global creators. Best of all, it's designed as a book-length sketchnote. Pick up a copy of the Sketchnote Handbook for yourself or for someone you just know will love sketchnoting. To learn more about my books, visit rohdesign.com/books. Use the code ROHDE40 for 40% off the book at peachpit.com. And now, on with the show. Everyone, welcome to the Sketchnote Army Podcast. This is Mike Rohde. I've got Nick Zuzanis on the phone, or on the Skype, or on the whatever this digital thing is, here to talk about comics and visualization and all kinds of stuff. Nick, welcome.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Hey, you're so welcome. I'm excited to have you on. I've been wanting to have you on the show, and I've had you on a long list for a while. And we met a couple of years ago. We were in New York City, my wife and I, and we happened to connect up, and you took us to a fantastic Greek restaurant. We walked around Central Park. Oh. It was a really great experience, and I've always appreciated that. I thought it was a really fun thing, a good memory. And but even more so, I've been a huge fan of the work that you do, which we'll get into, and the book that you produce. So I don't want to spoil it. I'm going to let you tell us who you are, what you do, and we'll get into it from there.
Sure. I'm Nick Zuzanis. I guess currently I'm a professor, assistant professor at San Francisco State University in Humanities and Liberal Studies, where I run a comic studies program. The thing you know me for, I did what's probably the first doctoral dissertation, at least in the Americas, that's entirely written and drawn in comic book form while I was a student at Columbia University. And that was shortly after published as this book, Unflattening, and has had a good life since then. So I've do that. And I'm a strong advocate for using comics and using visual methods in education, which is the argument of Unflattening. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of focus for my classes and my teaching and workshops that I do around that. And I've made other comics as well, including one on climate change for Nature for the 2015 Paris talks and some others. So that's me.
Well, you sound like a fellow traveler in this whole visualization space, which many sketchnoters are fascinated by and into. So thanks for being willing to come and talk a little bit about it. Let's go back to your days at Columbia and the dissertation that you worked on. What was it that made you think of doing your dissertation in a comic? Like, what was the early formation of that? Was that something you'd thought about for a long time? I think you, as I understand, you were into comics for a long time before that, which is many of us could say as kids we come into it. Where was the genesis of this idea of turning your doctoral dissertation into a comic book?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the truth is I didn't know any better. I just, it's true. I mean, I was a comics maker as a kid. Mm-hmm. I put out my own comic through high school. I put this character Locker Man, had about 16 issues in high school, and I kept making them. But, you know, when I went to undergrad, as was the case at the time I went there, studying, doing anything in comics was not an intellectual activity or an option at all. And I wanted to do, I wanted to do smart things. So I studied mathematics, but I was always working on comics, but it just wasn't something you could call that kind of work. I wouldn't have thought of it. And so it's later I was in Detroit. I ran Arts Magazine and a lot of things in Detroit where I'm from. And, I was asked to be in an art show, a political art show around the 2004 election. And I turned to comics cause I only had a couple days to do it. And, And that triggered some interesting ways of working. I was working rather than narrative with visual and verbal metaphor. And that shortly after that, we put on an exhibition of art and games at a gallery. And my buddy said, "Why don't you do the essay as a comic book?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's a good idea." So I did this long form comic on the history of games, how they work, and sort of a philosophy comic by the end of it. And it was these pieces that when I decided to go get my doctorate, I said, this is the kind of work I can do. I like being in education, but I didn't really like the fact that it tended to leave people out. And I didn't think that it was a matter of people being smart or not smart. It was really about vocabulary and having vocabulary to be in it. And I thought with comics, I could sort of transcend the word, but the problem here I am coming up and I can't find the words. I could transcend some of the boundaries people had because they just didn't know the language. But without making it simple, there's nothing about my comics that you would ever say is simple. Mm-hmm. But it's this sort of density of images speaking to other images and images speaking to text, and all those sort of different kinds of juxtapositions could do something that is quite complex, but still readable, still something you can give to somebody and they'd say, "Oh, this looks fun to read." And they'll sit down and read it. And it's a lot deeper than they thought, but they're able to stay with it. So I guess that's really the genesis. And I didn't know that it was that big a deal when I came to school. I just thought, well, of course, comics have been accepted in many places now. And why would this be any different?
Interesting. So it sounds a lot more like an evolution, like you slowly were moved toward this idea over time, starting with this essay and seeing how that worked. And then I imagine having done that essay probably helped you see like, well, I actually could produce a PhD level dissertation in this format. I'm sure it was probably a foundational piece of it. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. I mean, comics have a history of being, denigrated, but they also have a history of only being seen as narrative, storytelling things. And it's with these pieces that I started to see I could do non-narrative and do, essays rather than, philosophical pieces rather than just telling a story. And not that there's anything wrong with telling a story, but the kinds of ideas I wanted to get at weren't really story based. And so here, I saw I could bring my love of comics to draw and write all in one thing together and talk about big ideas, but in a way that I could reach a lot of people. So I think it's an evolution. It's not like I got to school and said, "Ooh, comics would be cool. I better learn how to draw." That would have been an uphill battle.
Interesting. So do you think, and this is, I'm sort of getting at the root of why comics work, and that could probably be a whole deep conversation basically the basis of your book, right? But I'm sort of guessing that maybe the reason that you're able to pull off maybe quite a deep essay with lots of reference and information is because of the ability to visualize things in something other than words or in addition to words. So, my thought about sketchnoting is it's powerful because you can combine the two together and they help each other.
Right.
So instead of just relying on having to read a narrative and form an image in your mind, you can actually have the image presented alongside the text and they help each other. Like the joke that I have when I teach people sketchnoting in a 1-hour workshop is I'll draw a picture of a house and I'll say, and it really helps that the word house is underneath it, right? Everybody laughs. But I mean, that's actually what it's all about, is this combination, sort of using all the tools you've got at hand to communicate. Is that a fair way to think of why comics are able to capture and share this information and sort of bypass all the limitations that maybe language alone would put on sort of a message like that?
Yeah, I think the key thing in what you said is why not use all the tools, not exactly how you put it, but all the tools at your disposal. Like we're visual creatures. Let's put that to use, that doesn't mean you have to be a drawer in the sort of highly rendered way that I do. Mm-hmm. But it means you know, let's put that to use and see how that's helpful to you. And, you know, I know for myself, and I certainly see in all my students, that people are helped an extraordinary amount, regardless of whether they're drawers in some sort of, you know, the sort of technical professional sense mm-hmm. that we've come to mean it. And I think, to me, that's a big part of my argument is, you know, we've sort of left drawing to the specialists, you know, the talented people,
right?
Rather than, hey, this is something that everyone does. And it doesn't, you know, we don't allow writing just for writers. Everybody's got to learn to write. But drawing has been left to the drawers. And I think we really are doing a disservice to how we think. And I think that's, you know, both important part of my work and my teaching.
Mm-hmm. So two directions I want to go next in the, sure. in this area is, number one, talk a little bit about the book's reception. And I know it's, you know, when I follow you, I just keep seeing all the different languages that it's appearing in, which is really exciting. So talk yeah. a little bit about the book reception, like all the stuff around the book itself. And was it surprising to you that it's done as well as it has or not? Or what's sort of your take on that?
I don't know. Surprised is quite the right word. I mean, it got a lot of attention when I was working on it, you know, because it hadn't happened. So there was a lot of like interest in that through academia. So I kind of expected some interest on that level. But that it's been picked up by so many different kinds of audiences, from designers to business people, to certainly I expected educators, which has been its larger thing, to comics people. And then it jumped abroad. You know, I think the Brazilian one may be the most, maybe it's not the most successful, but it's like, you know, it's in comic shops and stuff, which it's mm-hmm. not so much in the United States because of how distribution works. Mm-hmm. I feel like I just did a bunch of interviews for the Chinese edition, and I think it's reaching a very different, I mean, I don't know, but I know from the nature of the questions, like they're really interested in how it's talking about pushing back against authority, which is a very different, you know, it's certainly a thread that's in the book, but it's not something, you know, nobody else has really asked me about that. But every Chinese interview asked me about it. So that was really interesting. You work by yourself for a bunch of years and you think, oh, that's cool. I hope a bunch of people read it. But to have as many that have is always kind of shocking. So I'm quite grateful. And, you know, what's more interesting than that is, that's awesome. But what's more interesting is when I get students or teachers or, you know, doctoral students or whoever they are sending me work they've done, which sometimes is in comics, but sometimes this past year I had a student did a dance. She choreographed a dance in response to the book. And, you know, I think she'd always been a dancer of some sort, but I think it'd been sort of in the background. But they used my book for their interdisciplinary core course or something like that. And she thought, well, what if I respond to this? You know, why should I just write a paper? Why don't I try to do this thing? And it's this really, really powerful, powerful performance they put on. And I think seeing things like that maybe has been the most exciting. Is that it's not that it answers people's questions, but it lets them go out and try their own things. And that's just really exciting to see.
Almost almost like a permission thing. And I wanted to take back to the term surprise. That was the best word I had in the moment. It's almost more like intrigued. Like, you know, in my book, I've been intrigued in the languages and the places where it's gone.
Yeah.
And the reactions to it, especially in the education, sort of came sure. a few years in and now is taken off with sketchnoting. And that intrigues me.
Yeah. So I think those people that uses it. Yeah. So there you go.
So, I mean, it's pretty intriguing to see how, and it's true that I think it's Seth Godin that says once you make something and you release it, it's not yours anymore, right? It now belongs to the people who consume it and react to it and respond and so forth. So I guess in some ways that's a little bit of a proof of that idea that, you know, who could have predicted that it would be in comic shops in Brazil? And it just, that kind of makes me smile thinking that there's some kid going in to get, you know, the X-Men and picks up this, you know, essay, this dissertation
conveniently disguised as a comic book, and then
right.
it sort of blows his mind, right? Like, and all these things again lead to this permission to respond to things in a way that's maybe different. If that could be even the core of what it is that you did by taking a dissertation and producing it as a comic, you know, of course there's the firsts of it, but it's right. it sort of breaks your mind a little bit into saying, well, why do we have to do it that way? Why couldn't we do it this other way? It just sort of gives you that little tiny kernel of alternative way of thinking about things, maybe.
Right. And that's the key. It's not to say everybody should be making comics as their dissertation work. I mean, that's cool and all, but I don't want to see a lot of bad comics. I mean, but what it does mean is that, you know, find the ways that work for you and let's bring them in. Let's bring them into the conversation rather than saying, no, this is the way it's got to be. And it's, I think in my early days, it really came off as a anti-text thing, which was not my intent, but I think, you know, the sort of boosterism for it and the boosterism for comics as a disparaged medium for so long that mm-hmm. came across. But it's not to say there's anything wrong with text. It's to say, what else can we do? How can we use what we've got and then make it better? How can you make your writing better from your drawing, which maybe, you know, maybe that's what the typical student of mine is going to do. They're not going to go make comics after they leave my class or sketch note after they leave their class, but maybe they will. Maybe they'll use it to think better for when they're doing their work. I think that's really important.
Yeah. Maybe it just becomes this way of thinking that's integrated into the way they work that they, if you ask them, do you do comics or do you do sketch noting? They would say, oh, I don't think so. But if you actually followed their daily work and maybe on a whiteboard, they're drawing steps in a process or, you know, using drawings that like they're actually doing it, but maybe they don't realize they're doing it because it's by then maybe so integrated in the way they operate that they couldn't identify it in some way.
Exactly.
That's kind of an interesting idea to think that once it gets absorbed into your process, you don't think of it as this distinct thing. It's just part of what you do, right?
Just part of what you do. And that would be a goal of mine is to how do we just make this not such an, I mean, you know, the novelty has certainly worked in my favor. But, you know, what if this was just another way of working? Not like, ooh, cool, somebody did their work in comics, but just like, well, you know, it's good or not good. That's really the only thing that matters mm-hmm. at that point. So I think we're slowly headed that way.
Hmm. So that brings me to, I'm curious about how you teach. So I think it's kind of cool that there's a whole discipline in comics study. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about what does that look like? So there's people out there thinking, oh, I'd love to go and do a comics study in the university. Like, what does that look like from your perspective for someone who can't even maybe imagine what that would be like? What kind of stuff do you do? How long does it take? Is it rigorous? All those kind of questions.
Come on, Mike.
Of course it is.
Of course it's rigorous. I mean, as rigorous as anything else. I mean, you know, I'll say comic studies is a very varied discipline, if it's even a discipline. So many of the comic studies programs or classes that exist prior tend to come out of English departments or film studies, maybe, or something like that. So ours doesn't, and it my particular one is very reflective of me. So it's part let's learn to read and be appreciators. I mean, that's important. Let's learn how these things work and learn some theory. And but it's also very heavily based on making as the way of learning, playing mm-hmm. as a way of learning. And I think the more I teach, the more I try to foreground the play element and the hands-on element as the way we figure things out. And, you know, and I don't, it's not about skill. It's about, which I think is an argument in your book as well. It's about, you know, thinking. It's about making these things through our thinking and, mm-hmm. and showing people how much they already know. That's sort of, I think mm-hmm. the biggest thing that comes out of a class that I teach, you know, how much do they already know about drawing and using space in the ways that comics do? Or, and it startles people. They're like, wow, I had no, you know, and it's really less about the technical skill, which can be learned if they're interested. So in my program, you know, people learn by doing, they learn by reading, they learn by reading theory about, how things are doing what they're doing. And then we're also, I think the other component of my program, and that's not necessarily everywhere, but is applications of comics. So, you know, I came through education, so I was very interested in how people would use comics in their classrooms, and I have students do that. But also, I mean, you know, like I said, I made this comic for nature. Like, what if, you know, you're a biology student, but you happen to be in my class, could you go back to the biology department and start making comics about what's going on there and help get some of that work out in a different way? And I think that's like one of the biggest growing things for comics. All my works have come out, I think all of them have come out from publishers who don't otherwise publish comic books. Because there's a lot of interest in it from so many different areas. But, you know, so if you can get some skills to understand how comics work, and you happen to be in a place where, wow, it'd be kind of cool to do a comic about this, and you can just do it, like, there's a place for that. And there's a need for it. I think there's a real need for it, because people are hungry to understand things, but they don't always have the right ways in. And I think comics can provide that really well.
Wow. That's sounds like a great program. I've often thought it would be fun to sit in some of the classes and see just what the how the classes go, what the reaction of the students are. Just to be a fly in the wall would be lots of fun. Not to say being a student, you know, as well. So what kind of students come to the course and to the discipline? Is it from all over the university? Is there a specific area that seems to be more represented than another?
You know, it's, I mean, we're so new, so, you know, there's still a lot of people who don't even know we're there. But I mean, I certainly have humanities and liberal studies students, 'cause that's what I'm in. And you know, they can get it for credit or things like that towards their major. But I get, in my making courses, I'll get some of the usual suspects. I'll get some animation students and art students, which is kind of new for me. All the places I taught before, I was in an English department in my postdoc in Calgary, and then at Columbia, I was in the education department. So I have more experience working with people who say they don't draw at all, and try to shake that up. So the working with the more trained drawers has been really interesting. It's just a different experience. But so we get those, but we get them from across the university. I get design students. I get history students, biology. I mean, I really, from across, I mean, my goal eventually, I get creative writing students quite a bit, you know, and it's probably less, there's probably more students who have zero experience drawing. I mean, since they were kids, and probably a little, you know, the making class. All the classes have making, but the making class, where that's the goal of the class, that tends to self-select a higher percentage of people who already consider themselves drawers of some sort. Yeah.
Interesting. I could just imagine being a student at a university and telling my mom and dad that I'm getting college credit to study comics. That would be like the most amazing thing to brag about as a student. So,
yeah. And what do the parents say then? Do your parents say awesome, or do they say, not with my money or not? you know, that's actually in my sort of opening class. That's a question. I do a midterm where it's part making, part analysis, and part tiny essay. And one of the options for the essay, which most students pick, is write a letter to a parent, or let's say a principal or superintendent or former teacher, saying why you should be studying comics in higher education, which gets some pretty amazing responses. I mean, they're not all amazing, of course, but, you know, and it still happens. You know, you still got Bill Maher on national TV or whatever saying comics are ridiculous or whatever he said a few months ago. So every time you kind of think that this argument is long, long won, you realize that there's still a lot of people who are, I mean, I'll say, you know, I did that climate comic, and one of the funniest questions I got right after it was like, who came after you first, the climate change deniers or the comics deniers? And I think it was about 50-50, you know?
Wow.
So, you know, so we got a ways to go.
There's always more work to do, which I guess is good and bad, right?
But I mean, for me, I went to undergrad and I was a comics maker and I didn't consider making comics as my work because it wasn't even, you know, it just wasn't like, wouldn't have been on my radar to think about such things. And so now I get students who weren't as into comics as me who all of a sudden are like, wow, this is really cool. And so it's a sea change and, you know, more to go, but it is pretty exciting.
So the last question on this line is, sure. Can someone major in the discipline that you're teaching? Is it at that point? I don't understand totally like how it fits into the overall university. Is that something that someone can get a degree in, or is it more of a piece of an overall puzzle?
You know, we're at a minor at this point. Okay. I'm the only dedicated faculty to it. I mean, so the people, there are other classes that come from other programs. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, it's only one semester in, we graduated 5 students with the minor already, that had taken some classes before it was official. So, it'll take some time to get a major. I don't know. There's about 5 schools that have minors. Doctoral mastery kind of, there's a master's program at the University of Dundee in Scotland. And I don't know that there's any school that has a major now that you asked that question. I actually think we could do it pretty quickly, but I don't know, you know, I'm pretty new to being officially at a university, so I don't know all those rules. But, you know, they can have whatever major they have and then have this as part of it.
Mm-hmm. That comes back to the discussion about it's just the tools that I use to get things done. So maybe in some ways a minor is better. I don't know. But I guess if you had a major, then you would have maybe more propagation of the use of it. But I guess you need more NICs to, you know, to pull that off, right, in your context. So
yeah, but, you know, bird by bird, right? You know, so I'm all right with where we're at.
So, Nick, how does this sketchnoting stuff fit in with the teaching that you do? We know you're doing comics and stuff. Is sketchnoting a part of that process? You mentioned there's some parts of it. Is there any other ways that it's impacted your teaching and your students?
Absolutely. You know, I think from meeting you the first time, I got really intrigued about it. And I'm not a sketchnoter. I have a hard time. I mean, I tend to draw when I'm listening to people, but I haven't really quite figured out how to do sketch notes. So I probably need to go to your workshop. But I make my students do it in my comics classes, and I have a visual communication class that's a little more broad than the comics one. And they really take to it. You know, some of them end up doing it all the time. But the most this experience that stands out the most, which I just really wanted to share with you, and I think it's a great testament to working in these ways. I had this student who wasn't a particularly strong or super engaged student in the class. And, you know, so they'd had their sketch note assignment. Like I showed him what it was and I gave him a couple examples and I think an article by you and a couple others, some examples that they could look at. And I said, how'd it go? And this girl kind of made a sour face and she said, I hated it. And I said, and she said, but after class, somebody asked me what we did in class and I remembered every single thing. Hmm. And I was like, that's the best thing ever. Cause like she wasn't in, you know, you got some students who are just like going to try stuff and love it. Cause they're just, that's just who they are. But she wasn't that person. She was like determined she was going to be mad that I made her draw or whatever the thing was. And she still was while she was doing it. But after the fact, she had this, you know, truly transformative experience, I think. Where she recognized the value in it, even as she was uncomfortable with it in the short run. So, so I've made it, I do it with all my classes and often it is an assignment, you know, just like take notes on the reading and post a sketch note from it. And, you know, we'll use that as our discussion point. And I think it's not comics. There's many, you know, there's differences, but I think getting them comfortable just making marks and thinking through images, whatever format they're doing it in, is really valuable. And like I said, students have taken to it so well that I just always make it a part of what I do.
Hmm. Well, that's fantastic to hear that that it worked for her even in spite of her liking the process and maybe I guess maybe doing it more would get her more comfortable. Probably is the reaction to forcing your way through that uncomfortability. I think, I don't know how long you've drawn, and I've drawn for a long time. I think one blind spot that I know I have is because I've drawn for so long and I've somehow managed to get away with it even through school, that I just, I don't relate to people having the fear of drawing in the way of like almost like a fear of speaking to crowds or other fears, sure. Right? But it's a real thing and people are afraid.
It's a real thing. It's a real thing. And I think, you know, I mean, for me, the purpose of that grids exercise that I mentioned is to get them to do drawing, but that they don't even realize that's what they're doing.
Right.
You know,
right.
They don't realize that that's because it's not about skill. And I emphasize so much that, look, I don't want you to draw things. I want you to draw lines, marks, or gestures and just do that and give them so little time that it's not until they're done that they can sort of see, oh, well, look at this thing I did. You know, how did that happen? Yeah.
Interesting. Well, thanks for sharing that story.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for your resource and making your book. It's been a big, big plus to a lot of my students.
Excellent. You know, we talked earlier about your book, Unflattening. So if you're listening to the podcast, we're going to have a link to find that. And it's in, I don't even know how many languages. How many languages is it in now, Nick? Do you even keep track of that?
I do. Eight, I think. I think
wow,
eight.
That's great.
I think that's right.
So we'll make sure to link in there, and then you can find if you're listening in a place where there's a local translation. I know there's Italian because my friend Mauro Ticelli was pretty excited about it coming out in Italian.
Yeah, that one looks sharp. I haven't actually gotten a physical copy of it yet, but it looks good from what I've seen.
Yeah. So sort of a nerdy technical question I hadn't thought of until now. So when someone buys the rights to do the language translation, is it relatively easy to do? I imagine the imagery is pretty much the same. Are they just simply replacing the text itself with a font that you recommend? And although I imagine German, I guess, could be, and other languages could be a challenge, Cyrillic, for spacing. Like, do you have any idea how that's handled?
Unfortunately, I don't have as much to do with it as I'd like. I mean, a few of them, I've had the Italians actually, I had a fair amount of interaction with, but it's already after somebody's worked on it. Hmm. It's just not, I would like to have more involvement because it's hard. It's difficult to do the way I write in particular, even though there aren't that many words. The words are so sort of metaphorically specific to the images. So even if you translate it in a way that means the right thing, it may no longer mean the right thing in relationship to the images. So it's
tricky.
You know, it's tricky. Even if it's shorter than you know, it's much, much fewer words than a book of the similar length. And then the spacing is an issue. I work, you know, replacing the letters is easy. I mean, that can be done with fonts and that's quite simple. But the boxes that they're in, at this point, there's not really dialogue in mine except for two lines of it. So there's all these captions, and I have kept the captions on a separate layer so that they can adjust the size of them, and they don't. So I don't know if they don't actually get that file, even though I created it with that very intentionally. I'm not sure if the translating, you know, I'm not sure if Harvard passes on that copy or not. So I don't know. It's always, I mean, the Korean one, they actually did a really good job, even though using like, you know, totally different characters and everything. Mm-hmm. But I think if they had a lot of words in a small box, they just like the font size just got smaller. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's some things that are aesthetically not as I would like them, but for the most part, I mean, they do, it's hard work.
Oh, yeah.
And, I'd like to have more involvement. So maybe the next time around, and it hasn't been in any that have been, it's not been in Japanese, or any other ones that would read a different direction. So I haven't had to deal with that, which is a whole other issue.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I know that the Chinese version of the Sketchnote Handbook, I got to see some bits and pieces, and I got a version of it. And the translator had lived in Holland for a while, so she understood Western culture as well as English and Mandarin as well. So, but I noticed that the samples that she sent me, actually, she had changed whole metaphors to make sense to a Chinese audience. Did you have any issues with any of that stuff? I guess maybe, you know, how much latitude does a Chinese translator have? And is that why there's so much of this? Are they interpreting it as resistance against authoritarianism? And do they amplify it maybe a little more? That's the challenge of having a translation. How do you know that they're being true to sort of your spirit? I guess you just don't know, right?
I don't. I mean, I Google translated a few things. So I found and I didn't learn that this was happening till a few translations had come out, and I realized later that there's mistakes going on. I have a passage where there's a lightning bolt, but the text is a pun. It uses the word lightning, like to weigh less, which American audiences butcher that. You know, I mean, that's a commonly misspelled. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll use the wrong word there. So I wasn't shocked, but I hadn't thought about it. And so I caught it in the Chinese one, and I don't, you know, they solved it. I don't know what they did, but it makes a translation is a whole new thing, right? Mm-hmm. And unless you're involved in it, and even then it's very difficult. And I think comics start to be a lot like translating poetry, rather than translating prose. Because of the image text connection. So, I don't know. It's really intriguing to me. I'd like to understand it better, but I don't speak any of the languages that's been translated into.
Same for me too. Yeah.
It's like, what can we do? You know, unless you can get someone you really trust and they give you the time. I mean, cause I don't ever get the time. Like I get, you know, the book comes to me with like 2 weeks to go before it's going to print. And they say, do you see any mistakes? And I find design mistakes, but so anyway.
That's about it. There you go. Interesting. Interesting. And my last parting thought on that whole line is that I think the fact that you got the dialogue to be as concise actually makes it harder for a translator, because it's almost like a perfectly set puzzle, right? You fit all the images and the language is super compressed and powerful. And so everything fits together, and when you start taking it apart, like with a puzzle, that's tricky. And then you try to put in other pieces, maybe it sort of doesn't work. Like maybe there's just a level of letting it be what it is, right? And hopefully the core message gets through, and maybe the details are not perfect, but it's a rough, you know, directionally it
makes sense. I mean, I think the translator has to be very creative. And I think the thing about comics that you think you said really well there is there. Like the design matters. Like, you know, you're writing and you've too many words and it scrolls on to the next page. Well, you can't do that in a comic, right?
Yeah.
So they've got to figure it out. And that affects my writing too. I certainly write a lot of the edits are made because like, well, I only have this much space here. I boxed myself into a corner, so I'm going to just cut words until I make it say it a better way, which is really helpful. I mean, it makes me be a lot less wordy than I am when I'm writing text.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit. I'm curious about the way you work. We sort of touched on this before we got started. Talk about the tools that you use for ideation and then how that changes when you go to, I guess, illustration or production maybe is a better way to describe it. Talk a little bit about that and the tools you're using as you go along for those who might be curious about trying some of these out.
Yeah. I work my sketches or my thinking, ideation used, is entirely done on paper, and specifically I buy really crappy cheap newsprint, you know, large scale, like 2x3 feet or three, something like that, that does disintegrate, which now I'm starting to regret because there's stuff I kind of wanted from the first book that I wish there's a way. I mean, I've scanned most of it, but it's destructive its self-destructive nature means that you don't get very
precious with it. Maybe
precious. Thank you. Yeah, you don't get very precious with it, and the scale of it means that you can see. You can see and start to make connections. And I think the thing about working in comics or working in visual medium is that your visual system is a really key part in how you create. So you know, I make sketches and I intentionally draw fast and poorly. And in poor, loose sketches, you start to see new things. It's really important to me to work in that way. At some point I tend to do my page designs. I have, what kind of books are these reverse? Rodea, Rodea grid books. And the grids are nice because I can sort of figure out the size of my pages. And, so when I'm like actually designing a composition, I often will work in that. And go back and forth between the two, but the large scale really helps me, and the cheapness of it just means go try things. Mm-hmm. And even though I know this, which is interesting, this follow-up book, which is much more about the process of creation and a lot of things I do in my classes and workshops, but aren't specifically in Unflattening. It's very much about how thinking comes from drawing and thinking comes from movement. And yet I caught myself for probably the first months working on the book, really trying to think myself to a solution. And it wasn't until I said, you know what, just get back to your sketch pads, and sat there and just started making marks until, you know, and then all of a sudden this like flurry of ideas poured in. So even though, you know, like I know this, I teach this, I preach it, you still often have to learn it the hard way. Which, you know, that's why we're doing it. But, so I that's how I start. And then, I had really hard time lettering, just really atrocious lettering, which can sink your comic book, even if everything else looks good. Mm-hmm. So I switched to working digitally, right when I came to my doctoral program. Those comics are the first I did, digitally. The first book was drawn on a Wacom Intuos, however you say either of those words. I think you said Wacom before, so maybe I'm wrong.
I'm not sure either. Yeah.
I don't know. And anyway, that company. So all my work was drawn on this thing. So, you know, I'm looking up at the screen and drawing on my lap or wherever the tablet was. All my work for last 8-10 years, something like that, was drawn on that after everything was kind of figured out. And certainly changes happened then too, but the bulk of it was figured out. Which I like working digitally. Allows you to change things a lot, and but it also allows you to change things a lot.
Yeah, it can sort of get out of hand, right?
You can get out of hand, and you know, I mean, you make a mark and I don't draw as well with it. I mean, I think I can eventually draw as well with it, but I have to really work at it. You know, I have to overwork at it to get as comfortable as I can with a piece of paper and a cheap pen. And then just this fall, I am now the owner of a Cintiq, which I didn't know. People told me it was going to be better, and it is significant. You know, my control of the pen is much better. So, I'm slower because now I'm trying to do more ambitious things with the drawing, but I'm faster because it's, I don't have to redraw as much as I did.
Right. And for those listening, a Cintiq, so the Intuos, or however you pronounce it, is basically a slate you plug into your USB port and you draw almost like as if you're using a mouse. That kind of, if you think of it that way. Right,
you draw with a pen. No, it's with a pen.
But you're using it as a mouse. Like you're not drawing on the surface you're drawing on. You're drawing somewhere else. And
right, you're drawing on the screen. Yeah,
that's what
you're. I mean, you're drawing on the pad, but the marks are showing up on the screen.
Yes.
And the Cintiq, the Cintiq is both the screen and the drawing surface.
Yes.
Like a large iPad or something. So
and the pen is quite precise, and you have lots of control over line and shape, I think, to a certain degree.
Yeah. And I'll say I do have an iPad, and it really seems good. I don't know how to use it into my workflow, but it's so easy to use. Easy. And the marks, it makes marks a little bit cleaner than I think the Cintiq in Photoshop can do. I use Photoshop, which doesn't give me any help. And I kind of like that. People tend to not know I've drawn it on a computer, which is great for me. But at the same time, I think there's probably better drawing engines that I just don't know about.
Interesting. So, now, when you do your stuff on Newsprint, is there certain tools that you like to use to draw? Just cheap pens, Sharpies, or do you use pencil on those? Like, what makes you feel best?
I have one right here. I have a Pilot Precise Rolling Ball V7.
Fine. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. They blow up on airplanes pretty consistently. I've learned how to keep the caps off and keep them upright the whole trip now, so I don't ruin any more pants. But I don't know. I think my dad had some of those and I stole it from him, and then I started buying more. I don't have strong tool fetishes at this point.
Yeah.
I like those. So I guess I do, but I don't, it's not based on anything, but that's the pen I happen to be using.
And if they went away, you'd probably find a replacement and wouldn't think too much about it, probably.
I think I probably would, but if somebody borrows my pen, I do make sure they give it back. So
so maybe it's a little bit more of a fetish than you.
Maybe it is. Maybe it is.
That's interesting. Interesting. So now we're going to switch into practical stuff and tips. So the way I like to frame it is I could imagine someone listening to this podcast, they're into sketchnoting a little bit. They're excited about it. They've seen benefits of visualizing and whatever they're doing, and they want to just break through to another level, or they just need some guidance and some help that Professor Zuzanis might offer them. What would be three things that you might suggest to someone in that kind of situation? Maybe that's a typical starting student for you that comes into your classes and is getting introduced to comics.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one to answer in words. It's an easier one to demonstrate. I'll say, and I think you've seen it, maybe you've participated in it. I made up this exercise the very first time I taught my comics course back at Columbia, so a long time ago now, and called Grids and Gestures. And it's kind of this non-representational comics making exercise where on a single sheet of paper you sort of carve it up into some grid-esque fashion that represents the shape of the experiences of your day. And you, rather than drawing things in it, you draw lines, marks, or gestures that represent what you were up to or how you felt. And I came up with it with the idea, like, you know, my students are like really into this, or people at talks I do, but when it's over, they's like, well, I believe it, but I don't draw. And so I wanted to think of something that would give them the feeling of what it is to draw and make comics without worrying about the skill, because that's a whole different thing, right? Like I've spent a lot of time drawing and studying drawing. Like you're not going to do that unless that's something you want to devote a lot of time to. But I do believe that, you know, as visual creatures that move around in space and know how to navigate things through their eyes and through their bodies, we all have access to that. So the exercise is always the starting point for my classes and workshops, and I did it as a Twitter challenge a couple times now. Gets people to see, and then it's a very short amount of time too. That's also key to it. Gets them to see how many decisions they'll make. You know, like somebody will, like, you know, some people use a very standard grid. Some will use. They'll tilt things a little bit and they'll snake the layout, or they'll, whatever the choices are, you look around a room of students or a workshop and you say, you know, look at all the choices everybody made in this short amount of time. And why did you choose to have, you know, dashed lines here and solid lines here and an open box here? You know, what was, and they're like making these very, you know, like, well, you know, this means my day wasn't quite over yet, or whatever it means, doesn't matter. That they start to, you know, get a sense of how to use space in the way comics do, but they also see how much they know about drawing, you know, that they think they don't, because they think drawing is like, well, can I draw the eyes right? you know? Mm-hmm. And like, if you can draw the eyes right, that's a technical skill. That's, you know, so that's where I start, and we kind of move from there. So I don't know how to put this into three steps. I think that's a really good one. I'm a fan of Linda Barry, the cartoonist Linda Barry's work, who's become a teacher of these things. And I do some exercises from her books about drawing, that, which I'm not going to think of right now for some reason. I'll say to you, I use both yours and Linda Barry's. I'll often do a thing like how to draw people if you don't draw people. Mm-hmm. And I have a slide from your book and from Linda Barry's book that, you know, I'm like, all right, let's just do these things. And there's a wonderful thing, Ivan Brunetti, he's got this thing that's just like, you know, let's say dime-sized circles with a dot kind of in the middle, but a little above, and then a little nose off to one side, and then it's a page full of them, and then just modifying it with the eyebrow. So you're just drawing like a little curve above the eye, or a sharp curve above the eye, or whatever you're doing. And I have students do that, and you see how much sort of lifelike expression you can give with just nothing, you know, that we recognize it. I mean, humans are pretty well primed to recognize faces and expressions with very little information. So I'll run them through things like that just to see, you know, to find other ways to draw expression, to draw things without needing to, you know, go study anatomy for 10 years or something. Not that I'm discounting that, because that's also really important, but that can be that can stop you cold.
Hmm. So it almost sounds to me like your recommendation here would be, that's okay. That I would interpret it the way I would interpret it would be observing that you probably can draw more than you think you can, and that there's exercises available that will help you see you've got a lot more skills sort of bound in that you didn't recognize, that maybe you can draw out by just exercising them, by doing. I think it seems
by doing. You know, this may not be a useful step, but I think it's useful to hear. I did a workshop with a bunch of professors and professional kind of people. And this woman made this sort of really ambitious cutout thing, three-dimensional. And she said at the end, she's like, I never really liked these artsy, craftsy things. And I was like, you know, that's not really a piece of art you made. It's a piece of thinking. And I think that concept, like if you think about the stuff we're doing as we're sort of making solid representations, or not representations, that's the wrong word, we're doing our thinking. I think that's the right word for it. We're doing our thinking in motion and in line, or, you know, mark or whatever. When you start to look at it that way, rather than, you know, is this a pretty picture or not? I think that really opens up what it can be, and that lets so many people back in the door. And that's really important. So, yeah, I guess my recommendations are Grids and Gestures, which is on my website. You can link to it. Linda Barry's work is really good for that. I think, you know, the key to her work is talking about, you know, what it when you try to, I forget what it is, but the fear, it's all about getting past the fear of drawing. And I don't know, some third thing. You can make it up. Read Mike's book. You don't have to draw pretty pictures. You just have to draw smart ideas, you know?
There you go. Excellent. So I know that you're pretty busy and you probably don't want to hear from people, but if they want to go see your work and sort of find you, I think you've got a website that they can visit, and I don't know how active you are on social at all, especially with book and kids.
I'm overly active on one, not overly. My website, spinweaveandcut.com, which you can probably link is easier than remembering that. And if you tune into Twitter at 1:30 in the morning, Pacific time, I tend to post something about whatever, because I'm working on my new book, and that tends to be when I stop working and I'm like, I'll put something up for the three people that happen to be awake, and it's always a few more people than I expect. So So I'm slowly working on the new work and teasing images of it or whole pages as I go to keep me going. I think it's nice to have the first book came out so much from public conversations I had about the work that I, you know, I really like that. You know, I want to spoil things, but I also, I want to make things that people are interested to look at and talk about. So I like putting it out there. So yeah, if you follow my Twitter thing, occasionally you will see glimpses of it.
I guess you could scroll back in that timeline and maybe piece things together. Is it in an early enough stage that you don't have a title for it, or like, what's your timeline for it?
Well, is my editor listening? it's behind. It's behind. Starting a new program here in a new city, and honestly, you know, your question about the success of the first book, it's been really good, but it's also kept me on the road. So, as you would know, so much more than I expected. That it was been hard to get deep into the new one. And having small children, which is the most awesome thing ever. You can't always work 12 hours a day or 15 hours a day. You're lucky if you can do three in a day. So it's a little slower, but it's, I hope within a year it's done. And shortly after that, it's out. But it has a title that may change, but it has a title and I am drawing on it possibly as we speak.
Interesting. Well, I think you gave some tips if someone is really into it. They could probably listen back to our discussion and sort of piece together the direction it's going. And that's enough for me, knowing you're doing a second book.
If you want, but
sure. Yeah. Let's take a minute and do that.
That's up to you. Yeah. So it's, I mean, I think what came out of doing the first one is, you know, Unflatting is very much an argument that drawing should count in scholarship, should count as a way of thinking. And I think people buy that, but there's still the argument, well, but I don't draw. And I don't want to make, I'm not against how-to books by any means, but that's just not me. I make metaphorical things and let people figure it out themselves. And so I want to make something that kind of gets you to understand who you are and how much, like we said, how much you know about drawing already and how you can kind of remember what you were when you were 7 or 6 or 5 or whatever age when you did draw and you didn't question it and you didn't, you know, you didn't have to be told you couldn't draw, you just made things. So I want to kind of look at who we are and what that means and how we can understand that moving and drawing and other kinds of modalities are a kind of thinking and how we can participate in that. So it's this grand sweeping thing with everything from how we learn as newborns to how we came about as a species to some stuff about consciousness and cognitive work that I'm not ready to say more about that because I have to draw it before I really understand it. So it's bigger than the other one. I don't know if it's longer, but it's bigger in terms of what I've had to teach myself along the way, which has been really fun, just very slow.
Yeah, it sounds like you're taking a difficult topic for your PhD and just stepping it up and going for an even bigger vision, which is pretty awesome. I'm excited to see when it comes out, whenever it is.
But it's coming.
Better coming. To be good than soon, right?
Yeah, that would be nice, but I think, you know, I you want to make something, at least I'm not a fast cartoonist in the first place, and I'm interested in things people will learn from the third and fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh readings rather than, you know, get it and say, oh, that was cool, and then put it away. So hopefully this will have that kind of payoff, and if not, I had fun making it.
Yeah, it's a win-win-win, right, if you're having fun with the process. And I think the fact that you're taking time to think about it and be so deliberate about it means to me that it's like Unflatting, it's going to be amazing again. So I'm confident in the work that you do, and I think you'll be just fine.
All right. Well, I heard it there first. You said
there you
it.
Go. There you go.
Thank you.
Back off, agent. Back off, everybody else.
Agent. I don't know. Yeah. Well, we'll see. Thanks, Mike.
Not a problem.
Yeah, that was fun.
Well, thanks so much for being on the podcast. And I think people are going to be pretty excited to hear about it. I think there's probably already plenty of fans out there already be excited to hear you talking about your work and the way you think about things. But there's going to be people who don't know about it and want to pick up that big, beautiful book from Harvard Press. You should definitely do it. Worth every penny. It's one of my favorite books. And thanks for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Mike.
Thanks for listening to the Sketchnote Army podcast. This podcast was created by me, Mike Rohde, and is edited and produced by John Schiedemeyer, who also created the theme music for the show. Special thanks to Chris Wilson for the show notes each episode. To support the creation of this show, I invite you to buy one of my books, the Sketchnote Handbook or the Sketchnote Workbook, either for yourself or a friend. You can find the books at Amazon or go to peachpit.com and use the code RODE40 for 40% off.